This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, the latest from New Zealand's volcano disaster, which has now killed at least six people and injured many so badly that they can't be identified. And while people are forced to breathe it, many of our politicians don't want to talk about it. Why is the smoke smothering our largest city so political?
The quiet Australians will not stay quiet. And the full age range, young people are concerned because they know they're going to inherit the problem. Older people are worried about their children and their grandchildren and the future that they're leaving as a result of inaction.
But first to New Zealand, where warnings of another eruption are stopping recovery crews from getting to the volcanic island, where Monday's eruption killed at least six people, with eight still missing and many more horrifically burned. Volcanologists say there have been several tremors in the area, which point to continued high pressure within the volcano. And New Zealand police officers say it's too dangerous to go onto the island. Burn specialists are working around the clock to help those who were injured and did manage to escape. Some of them, though, are too burnt to speak or to be identified. The ABC's Norman Hermont is in Whakatane. Norm, can you feel the tremors where you are?
No, Eleanor, we really haven't felt anything. Now, it's worth noting that White Island is about 50 kilometres offshore here. So if those tremors are in any way sort of minor or localised, we really wouldn't be feeling them here in Whakatane.
When do the recovery crews say they will be able to get onto the volcano?
Well, we were listening to police at a press conference this morning, and they were facing quite a bit of pressure on that front, not only from journalists, but obviously family members. There are people who are very eager to recover these bodies of the presumed dead on White Island at the volcano. And they continue to stress that they are really not in a position to undertake that while they are getting word from the Geological Service that conditions are not safe. So as long as they continue to get that advice, they really can't go ahead. Now, one of the issues that is on the horizon is it's been perfectly clear weather for the last couple of days. That is supposed to take a turn for the worse tomorrow, and that could obviously hamper any sort of rescue operations if they were to get the go-ahead. But as we've discussed, it looks like the unstable situation in terms of the geology, where the volcano is really preventing them from getting the go-ahead so far.
And Norm, what can you tell us about those people who were rescued and are in hospital?
Well, we are hearing a number of cautions that those people, we found out today that the number is 25 who are in critical condition, and many of those injuries are extremely severe. Large parts of the bodies are very, very badly burned. And Eleanor, a number of them have inhalation injuries. So some of the gases that were released, sulfur, hydroxide. Sometimes this has been breathed into some of these people. Also, it's worth remembering when the ash first came out of the volcano, its recorded temperature was something like estimated at 100 to 120 degrees. So if people had been breathing that in, obviously there could be real damage, internal burn damage, and then obviously gases and steam burns as well. So really, really difficult. And we, you know, the Ministry of Health has really advised people that it is a very real possibility that some of those who have been critically injured may not survive.
Such a difficult time. Norman Hermont in Whakatane, thank you. Well, New Zealand's coroner has already begun post-mortem examinations on the six people whose bodies have been recovered and has vowed to get them back to their families as soon as possible. And specialist burns teams are stretching hospital resources as they treat the injured. Gavin Coote has more.
In declaring a mass fatality incident, New Zealand's chief coroner, Deborah Marshall, says post-mortem examinations have now begun.
We will be working as hard as we can to return any deceased to their whānau.
That process is taking place in Auckland, where a team of coroners is working to identify five of the victims. Bruce Bird is the country's acting assistant police commissioner.
This is because we are conscious of returning loved ones to their families, wherever their families are, as soon as possible. We believe the expertise and numbers of pathologists based in Auckland can help ensure the process is smooth, accurate, and as swift as possible.
A sixth person who died overnight at Middlemore Hospital will be examined separately. And as volcanic activity steadily builds again on the island, authorities are continually assessing when they can return there. But police remain reluctant to put rescue teams in further danger to recover the missing eight people from White Island.
We've got to be certain of the environmental situation out there on the island, what's that's happening, and then we can make some decisions once we've got all of that information. Safety for our staff is a huge priority for us, and we've got to get this right.
Among the major challenges is treating survivors with serious burns. 30 people are in hospitals across the country, with many being treated by specialist burns units. Heather Cleland is a plastic surgeon and head of Victoria's Adult Burns Unit at the Alfred in Melbourne.
It's very important that patients with severe burns are managed in specialist burns units, and New Zealand has a national burns service.
Heather Cleland says even the best burns units can become stretched in these types of situations.
Any burn service, any specialist burn service in any country in the world, no matter how good their health system is, will find it very difficult to deal with multiple patients with severe burns. And, you know, we're talking for an average Australian burns unit, and for massive burns, say more than 50% total body surface area, most burns units would say that they would start to struggle to look after and still keep going with their regular patient load, more than 5 to 10 of these patients in one unit.
And treating even one burns patient requires a large amount of resources.
The supply of donor skin, which we store here in Melbourne at the Donor Tissue Bank in Victoria, is key to managing these patients in a controlled fashion and getting their wounds covered at least temporarily. So the Donor Tissue Bank is a key player in these mass casualty events.
The danger posed by White Island is perhaps one of the lures for tourists, but some feel those visiting the volcano when it erupted may not have been fully aware of the imminent risk. Eric Clementi is a volcanologist at Denison University in the United States.
They're fascinating to go to, but they are places that are inherently potentially unstable because they're places where there's a lot of heat, and a lot of water, and the potential for explosions. And people sometimes, I think, get the impression that visiting a volcano is like visiting Hawaii, where there's lava flows that are you can get out of the way when things are potentially getting more active. But for an explosion, sometimes it's fine one moment and not fine the next.
That's volcanologist Eric Clementi, Gavin Coote reporting. Well, there was some hopeful news for families of the missing last night, with Adelaide woman Lisa Dallow found alive but critically injured in a burns unit in a hospital in Hamilton. Mrs. Dallow's husband, Gavin Dallow, and her daughter Zoe are still missing. Our reporter, Rhett Burney, spoke to Mr. Dallow's sister, Meredith Dallow, a short time ago.
At this stage, yeah, there's still Gavin and Zoe on the missing list.
And how's the family coping? Because you are so far away from where this is happening.
It's a struggle, but we just wait for some news, and we're in contact with the consulate, and it's just a waiting game, really.
And I understand that Lisa was found in a hospital in Hamilton late yesterday. Has that spurred on a bit of hope that perhaps Gavin and Zoe may be also in hospital?
That's what I pinned my hopes to, that they've been taken to different hospitals, yes.
How did you find out that they were on White Island?
They were on the, there was a list of names from that they had from the cruise ship that had obviously gone on the day trip to the island.
So when you found that out, what went through your mind?
I think we were just in shock and didn't really know what to think or do. And because at that stage, I didn't really know how bad things were or anything. It wasn't really until the next morning later that night that I actually realised how bad things were.
Yeah, some of the pictures that are coming out from White Island after that eruption are pretty confronting. I'd imagine for family it must be so much more worse.
It is. It's Yeah, I guess it is horrible being back here, but then I think there's nothing we can probably do over there either, so we're probably better just staying put here until we get some up-to-date information, and then we can decide what our next moves are.
And Lisa's brother is over in Hamilton with her at the moment?
Yes. Yeah, I spoke to him very briefly yesterday, and only that he had located and found Lisa, so that was really all, and that, yeah, he hadn't located the other two.
Was he able to provide an idea of how severe Lisa's condition is at the moment?
All we know is that she's got burns to 57% of her body, and she's in an induced coma, and obviously she's in a critical condition.
That's Lisa Dallow's sister-in-law, Meredith Dallow, speaking with our reporter, Rhett Burney, in Adelaide. Well, back in Australia, the air quality in the country's biggest city has improved somewhat today, bringing relief to Sydneysiders who choked their way through dangerous readings more than 11 times hazardous levels yesterday. But around 100 bushfires are still burning, and the political debate over what's behind the unprecedented conditions isn't going away either, as Julia Holman reports.
Scientists say there's no debate that these bushfires and the associated smoke blanketing large parts of the country's east coast are intensified by climate change. Some Australian politicians, even on the Conservative side, also agree.
Look, what we're seeing at the moment is some of the hottest temperatures on record. I mean, this year is the second hottest year in New South Wales' history, following last year, which was the hottest year in New South Wales' history. We're seeing a record drought, which is the worst in living memory. And we're seeing these extreme bushfires. These are all the things the scientists told us would happen as a result of climate change.
That's the New South Wales Energy and Environment Minister, Matt Keane. He expressed that view at a clean energy conference yesterday and again this morning.
This is not me saying it, it's the scientists and the experts saying that. And we should be stopped putting ideology into this debate and start putting the science and the expert opinion into the debate. It's about time that happened.
But Matt Keane's frankness isn't replicated within his own Liberal Party.
The focus has to be on looking after our communities that are struggling through very intense and current conditions right now, have the philosophical debates about what's caused these bushfires and droughts. I live in a regional community. Clearly we see our climate changing and some issues that we have to deal with as part of that. But for now, the focus has to be on looking after those communities that are struggling and that are hurting.
The New South Wales State Education Minister, Sarah Mitchell, told RN Breakfast the state government has the situation under control.
We've had massive school closures over the last few weeks in New South Wales. One day a few weeks ago, we had over 600 schools shut because of the fire activity. And it is a concern and we need to manage it appropriately, but in line with our school communities, and that's what we do.
And at the federal level, the reluctance to even discuss any link to climate change continues.
Well, indeed, Matt Keane has made those comments. He's not in my party. He's a member of the Liberal Party. I'm a member of the National Party. In fact, I'm the leader of the National Party.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, distanced himself from Matt Keane's comments, and the man who thinks climate change is only an issue for inner-city raving lunatics argues that most of the bushfires we're seeing are the result of arsonists.
Most of these fires have been caused by little Lucifers running around with matches and fire starters and creating havoc.
And the Federal Communications Minister and Sydneysider Paul Fletcher was asked three times if he agreed with his New South Wales colleague Matt Keane that the bushfires are exacerbated by climate change.
Matt Keane is a friend of mine. I have a high opinion of Matt. I'm not a subject matter expert. I've not had the chance to read his speech.
The minister continued to dodge the question.
What I would say is that we know that the issue is temperatures, dryness, and all of these are clearly relevant factors.
John Hewson is a professor at the Crawford School at the Australian National University and a former leader of the Federal Liberal Party.
Paul Fletcher, the Minister for Communications, failed completely to communicate.
He's accusing Paul Fletcher and other coalition members of obfuscating.
Paul did everything he could not to admit that link. And you say to yourself, why? Just he looked ridiculous. Sounded incredibly dumb in terms of not being able to answer the question. It's because they're playing a silly political game where they don't want to be seen to be held accountable for more action on climate change. And so they're out there obfuscating. They just don't want to admit the link because they know then that they'd need to focus on the transition that would be required for this country to make a, you know, the move to a low carbon society, net zero emissions by 2050.
John Hewson was at the same Sydney conference yesterday where Matt Keane delivered his speech.
People put it to me, he's broken ranks within the coalition. I mean, he's stating a position and he stated it quite strongly, but, you know, everyone agrees.
And he's warning political parties not to ignore the widespread community concern.
Young people are concerned because they know they're going to inherit the problem. Older people are worried about their children and their grandchildren and the future that they're leaving. And it's grossly irresponsible inaction.
And that's the former federal Liberal leader, John Hewson. Julia Holman with our report. Well, New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian also spoke out on the issue this afternoon, backing her Environment Minister's statements on the need to deal with climate change.
Well, look, climate change is a reality. And we've accepted that as a government since the day we came to government. We know climate change is a reality. We know that we're experiencing extreme weather conditions. And we know that all governments have to act in that regard. And I'm proud of my government's record in that regard. But I also appreciate at this time, I think the community can appreciate that I'm focusing on making sure we're doing everything we can to protect property and life. But of course, I accept the fact of climate change. Of course, I accept that all governments around the world have to play their part in addressing these extreme weather conditions. And I expect my Environment Minister to be a champion of those issues.
That's the New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And you can follow me at Eleanor Hall 1. Still to come on the program, she sang the song considered by many to be the best breakup ballad of all time. Roxette's Marie Fredriksson dies after a long battle with cancer. Waiting times for surgery in public hospitals are increasing across the country, with some people suffering for years before they get relief. In emergency departments, the waits are also getting longer, with the figures worse than they were 4 years ago. But the Public Health Association says despite this, Australia's public health system is still world class. Isabel Rowe has our report.
Tasmanian woman Helen Manser has been in pain for more than 2.5 years.
Terrible. It's been terrible. Just taking daily antibiotics, like the pain and discomfort has been unbearable on sometimes, but you don't have a choice. You've just got to wait.
Yesterday, she got a life-changing phone call telling her that she'd finally reached the top of the waiting list for surgery. And today in Melbourne, Helen Manser will have the operation she needs.
It's urology surgery that couldn't be performed in Tasmania, but it took them 2 years to decide it couldn't be performed in Tasmania. So then it was referred to the urology at the Austin Hospital, and then it was postponed a couple of times here on this end until now.
It's not the 60-year-old's first experience with the Tasmanian elective surgery waiting list, and it's also not the longest she's waited.
I was about 5 years waiting for the knee replacement. Had an ankle fusion a few years before that, which I waited a long time for. I've had lots of surgeries. I'm a bit of a wreck, to be honest.
Data released today from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows Tasmania has the longest elective surgery waiting times in the country, an average of 57 days. The head of the Institute's Health Systems Group, Dr. Adrian Webster, says across the country, elective surgery waiting lists are growing.
Essentially, we're seeing more people added to waiting lists every year than are coming off and receiving surgery. We're seeing growth rate per year of about 2.5% in the number of people being added. It's been around 2.1% for those actually receiving surgery, being admitted to hospital for surgery. So what this unsurprisingly does is translate through to an increase in the average waiting times, the median waiting times.
Some states are performing better than others. The Institute's data shows in New South Wales, 97% of patients are being admitted for their surgery in the timeframe recommended for their condition. The Public Health Association of Australia warns the data can be misinterpreted because each state calculates its own performance slightly differently. And Chief Executive Terry Slevin says there are several factors weighing on the system.
I mean, there's a couple of things. We all know about the fall in private health insurance, and that's going to have some impact on the public system. We know the population is growing, and we know the population is ageing, and so we're seeing an increase in burden of chronic disease, and those chronic diseases will certainly be contributing to that demand demand on the public hospital system.
The data paints a similar picture in the country's emergency departments. 71% of people are being seen within the appropriate time. That's down from 74% 4 years ago. The situation is most dire in the ACT, where more than half the people who present to emergency are forced to wait too long. Terry Slevin believes in preventative healthcare to reduce the burden on public hospitals. He's concerned about a recent decision in New South Wales to remove lockout laws for pubs and clubs, saying that will place further strain on emergency departments in that state.
We'll revert to a higher level of consumption late at night, where we know that accidents, injuries and violence will be exacerbated if and when those laws are reverted. That will put increased demand on the public system.
But he maintains, despite the increasing waiting times, Australia's public health system still ranks above many others around the world.
Australia has one of the best longevity life expectancy data around the world. We're in the top five for most of those categories. And in terms of our healthcare system, it is absolutely one of the best in the world.
That's the Chief Executive of the Public Health Association, Terry Slevin. Isabel Rowe reporting. The pop songs of Roxette made the Swedish duo worldwide stars in the 1990s. Today their fans are mourning the death of singer Marie Fredriksson, who's being remembered as a dynamic performer with a one-of-a-kind voice. Roxette sold 80 million albums worldwide and their songs broke into the US and UK charts. Rachel Mealy has our report.
Marie Fredriksson and Per Gessler first met in the 1970s but got together to make music in 1986 at the suggestion of a record industry executive. Their first big hit, The Look, took off in the United States. Music journalist Sean Sennett says the world hadn't seen anything like Roxette at the time.
They were really quite an incredible, wonderful anomaly when they came out, because in Australia we sort of became aware of them towards the end of the 80s and the early 90s. And, you know, pop music was changing, things like grunge were on the rise, and Roxette, and particularly that amazing voice of hers, became a soundtrack for everybody that loved pop music.
They even joined the ranks of bands referencing themselves in their music. Fredriksson's spiky blonde hair was as much her signature as her bold vocals.
She had a very striking look. She almost seemed, for those of us that weren't aware of her early career, only became aware with Roxette, it was like she was a classic pop star in the mould of, like, say, how striking Annie Lennox was in previous times.
Marie Fredriksson was first diagnosed with a brain tumour in 2002. While the tumour was successfully treated, she suffered ongoing health problems as a result of the radiation therapy. Today, her musical partner, Per Gessler, paid tribute to her talent in a post on Facebook. "You were a truly unique musician," he said. "A singer on a level we will hardly ever experience again. You painted my black and white songs with the most beautiful colours." Music journalist Sean Sennett recalls interviewing Roxette on a tour of Australia in the 90s.
Marie was a very passionate woman, and somebody that sort of, that's sort of the way the Swedes have with pop music, with the hooks they were writing. And the songs just really hit a chord with people. So when they came back in 2015, it was like an army of devoted Roxette fans turned up to see them. Like a teardrop.
For all the pop songs, Roxette was also famous for this ballad, which has been described today as possibly the greatest breakup song of all time. It must have been love, but it's over now. It was all that
I wanted. Now I'm living without. It must have been love from Roxette. And incidentally, December the 11th is the most popular day of the year for a breakup. Apparently there are people who study these things. Rachel Mealy with our report. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Enjoy the song.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
We're less than 2 weeks into the Australian summer, but it already feels like it's been a lot longer than that.
All anyone can talk about right now is the bushfire crisis and the air quality. So today on The Signal, what does the data say about the exact difference between your summers, the summers your parents used to have, and the next 20 to come?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.